Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Getting any kind of substantive legislation passed by Congress and enacted into law is incredibly difficult in the modern age. Relatively little of substance was enacted by the 115th Congress between 2017 and 2019, the most glaring exception being the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. While many of the provisions, such as those changing individual and corporate tax rates, were highly publicized and debated, one provision that received little attention at the time allowed a special tax treatment for investments in what were called opportunity zones, areas of the country that were economically disadvantaged.
One of the extraordinary aspects about the history of the opportunity zone provision is that its inclusion was largely the result of a sophisticated lobbying effort funded by Scott Parker, a Silicon Valley billionaire who was able to enlist the support of two prominent African-American senators, Democrat Cory Booker and Republican Tim Scott. The theory behind the legislation was that by providing special tax breaks to investments in certain left-behind communities, a flood of private investment would rush in and bring about the kind of development that years of government efforts had failed to produce. So, how did Parker and his organization pull off this extraordinary feat of getting the provision into law? How does it work for taxpayers? How has it been implemented by the government? And most importantly, is it producing the kind of inner city and impoverished area development promised by its backers? Our tour guide this morning into the world of opportunity zones from inner city Baltimore to the opportunity zone that curiously includes the Mandalay Bay Hotel on the Strip is David Wessel. His new book, Only the Rich Can Play, is a sweeping and often funny look at the opportunity zone landscape. Good morning, Mr. Wessel, and welcome to Mountain Money.
David, are you there? We cannot hear you.
And it's that kind of morning on Mountain Money.
I know. Let's have David, if you can, call that backup number at the bottom. And Roger and I will be back right after this.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hello? Hello?
So, David, I don't know if you heard the little intro we did, but can you start by telling our audience a little bit about what motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Oh, boy. David, are you still there?
I'm here. I'm sorry. I could hear you, but I couldn't hear me in the app.
That's
now
okay.
Now we can hear you. Yes, that's what we need.
Go ahead.
Great. Okay. So, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for the glitch. So just one correction, his name is Sean Parker, the guy who Timberlake played in The Social Network. okay. So I'm sure he'd be offended if he got his name wrong after all the energy he spent to promote himself. This is a really interesting story on two grounds. One is it shows how Washington works these days. A billionaire with well-intentioned, I believe, basically creates his own little think tank, hires experts, manages to convince the members of Congress to help get his pet proposal into the sprawling 2017 tax bill, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. But the second thing is, it turns out it's really, really hard to figure out how to use the tax code to direct rich people to put their money into the kind of neighborhoods that Congress would like the money to go. And I think Opportunity Zone shows just how difficult that is.
So let's help the audience by setting the stage a little bit. Can you explain how the Opportunity Zone funding mechanism works and what advantage it presents to a taxpayer who might have a capital gain?
Sure. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act Opportunity Zone provision created 8,764 tax havens across the country. And if you're lucky enough to have a capital gain, that is a profit on the sale of some asset, you sell it. You have to pay capital gains tax on that, but you get a reduced rate and you get to delay paying taxes on it. But more importantly, you take the proceeds of that investment, invest it into almost anything in one of these 8,764 census tracts. And if you hold on to it for 10 years, you don't have to pay any taxes whatsoever on the profits you make on that investment.
There's a hope, though, that that investment is doing something for the communities that it, you know, the money's invested in. What is the philosophy behind that?
Right. So the philosophy is that we have, correctly, lots of communities in America that have been left behind over the last several decades, and they're not perhaps the most attractive places to invest. So if you give wealthy people an incentive to put money into those census tracts, presumably they will help spur economic development and jobs. That was the selling point. But there are a couple of problems. One is the law created a list of census tracts that were eligible. More than half the census tracts in America were eligible, and the governors in each state got to pick up to 25% of the zones from that list to be blessed with this tax break. Some of them chose wisely, some didn't. Some of them thought, like, well, why put the incentive in a really bad neighborhood where no one's going to invest? Let me, as the governor of Oregon did, make all downtown Portland, Oregon an opportunity zone. So a lot of the money is going to the best off of these 8,764 zones. We don't have a lot of data, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, but the data we do have suggests that most of the money is going to half the zone, 1% of the zones. Half the money is going to 1% of the zones. So that's one problem. Money is going to places that probably didn't need the incentive, and it's starving places like inner city Baltimore that really need the money. The second thing is there's no requirement that the investment benefit the people who live in a community. So we have self-storage facilities going up, which imply nobody. We have luxury student housing going up in some college towns that qualified only because college kids show up as poor in the Census Bureau. There's a Ritz-Carlton condo and hotel complex going up in downtown Portland, Oregon. There are condos and hotels going up all across the country because there was no requirement that the people who are making these investments even state that they were going to help people in the community. Now, to be sure, there are some good examples of how the thing is working the way it should. There's a really interesting group in South LA doing affordable housing. But from the best I can tell, and the data is really sketchy, most of the money is going either to places that didn't need the incentives or to projects that probably aren't doing a lot of good for the community in which they're located.
And one of the interesting things that you know in the book is that there wasn't a lot of sort of data requirements imposed as part of this program. And part of the reason that you don't know and we can't find out what this is happening is that there's a minimal requirement for reporting. You just build in an opportunity zone and file your tax return, right?
Right. So on one hand, the proponents thought that previous place-based tax policies didn't work very well because there was so much red tape and you had to justify to the Treasury that what you were doing met the rules and stuff. And there were limits on how much money could go into these things. So they went all the way in the other direction. They said, fewer rules, maybe some of the money will be wasted, but we'll have so much money that it'll do good. Then, so part of it is philosophy. They didn't want the Treasury to be able to have the power to say this project yes, this project no. But the second thing is those of us in Washington have heard a lot about the reconciliation process in the Senate by which a bill can be passed with only 50 votes as compared to the usual 60 votes that are required. If you go through reconciliation, as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act did, the peculiar rules of the Senate say every provision has to do something to spending or taxes. And the provision in the Opportunity Zones legislation that would have required more reporting was stripped out as part of this process. And the Treasury, the Trump Treasury, wasn't very demanding. I think they could have demanded more in getting data. So we have very little data. And so that just means that if you're a critic of the program, you can cite examples on one side. If you're a proponent, you can cite examples on the other. I'm hopeful that Congress will require the Treasury to come up with some data. There's some moves in that direction. And there is legislation that both proponents and opponents of Opportunity Zones have signed on to change the law, but it's not a high priority of anybody in Congress, I'm afraid.
So right now, there's really no way of telling how many programs are actually being implemented, but more importantly, the net cost to the Treasury. And of course, we won't know that for 10 years because we won't know what the capital gains that are taxes that are being foregone are.
Correct. So we have little bits of data. So for instance, there were some economists at the Joint Committee on Taxation of Congress who got access to 3/4 of the 2019 tax returns filed by Opportunity Zone funds. And what they found is that 84% of the zones got no money, and half the money went to 1% of the zones. So that's one shred of data. And then, you know, what some people deride as anecdotes, I'm a former newspaper man, I call reporting. You can go around to a community, as I did, in Baltimore and Portland, Oregon, and talk to people about what is this an Opportunity Zone project? And sometimes they'll tell you. Sometimes it spills out into the public record in various ways. Some of the big investment funds put on their websites pictures that are Opportunity Zone projects. Anthony Scaramucci, who's a rather colorful guy who spent a few days as President Trump's communication person, has a fund. He said he was going to raise $3 billion. So far, he's raised $45 million and done one project, a Virgin Hotel in a gentrifying area of New Orleans. So we can see, we have some anecdotal evidence. It's not adequate, but it's the first stab, and that's what leads me to the conclusions I have in the book.
Sorry, I'm just pausing only in the fact that, you know, as you said, there's no reporting. There's really no criteria in order for this land to be designated. And as well, there's no requirement that these jobs or the projects that are being funded even have to benefit the communities themselves. You know, it's not necessarily what the community wants.
No, the community has very little role in this, except in the sense that local zoning is often an issue. And, I mean, that's one of the criticisms of the program. There's a guy named Aaron Siebert at the Kresge Foundation that was kind of intrigued by Opportunity Zones, and they put some money into trying to provide technical assistance to communities. And he made the observation to me that the proponents of Opportunity Zones think all money into a community that needs money is good money. And he disagrees. He thinks that, you know, building some luxury condos in a place that happens to qualify because there's a public housing project in that census tract and it shows up as poor, he doesn't think does a lot for anybody except, of course, the construction workers. So that's one of the criticisms of the program, that it doesn't require even an assertion that you're doing something for the people of the community. It's as if the money comes, then prosperity will follow, and I don't think the evidence for that is very strong.
You mentioned earlier that almost half of the nation's census tracts could potentially qualify for an opportunity zone, and that the governors of individual states then had the power to designate a certain number of those census tracts within each state as an opportunity zone. Anytime you give governors that kind of power to influence a significant financial benefit, you see some interesting results. Can you share a little bit about some of those results that might seem a little questionable?
Yeah. So one of the things that the proponents of Opportunity Zones, the think tank that Sean Parker founded called the Economic Innovation Group, one of their principles was the less Washington bureaucracy, the better. And so they had this rationale that, oh, take it closer to the people, take it to the governor's offices. And as someone who covered a state capital in Connecticut for a while, which is probably one of the cleaner states, the notion that somehow state capitals are paragons of social science and virtue is just crazy. So the governors had very little time to make choices. In Texas, Austin, Texas, which is one of the fastest growing metro areas in the country, asked for 4 opportunity zones. The governor, for some reason, gave them 21. In California, initially, Governor Jerry Brown designated the Stanford campus as an opportunity zone, but that list was published and that caused a big uproar, so that was pulled back. But parts of Berkeley are an opportunity zone. In Baltimore, it's kind of interesting. Mostly the zones are pretty well chosen, I think, but there was one zone that didn't make the original list for technical reasons. Then suddenly it did make the list, and the governor designated it despite the fact that the city hadn't asked for it. And this is a huge development in the south part of Baltimore that already has about $600 million worth of local tax incentives. And it had attracted $250 million of money from Goldman Sachs, its own money. And now new investors are being able to invest in that with having this foundation that's provided by Goldman Sachs. In New York State, apparently Governor Cuomo originally didn't want to do anything with this because it was, you know, dirty because it was the Trump tax bill. But in the end, 25% of the state of New York's opportunity zones are in Brooklyn, which is one of the fastest growing parts of the state of New York. And then in Nevada, there was some fancy footwork where the governor of Nevada the senator from Nevada, Senator Heller, lobbied the Treasury Secretary, and they bent the rules a little bit to create an opportunity zone that wasn't there already that had a lot of popular support from real estate developers. So there are places, what I was struck by is Oregon, I think they had a pretty good process, but the governor's office basically said, if we only pick really bad neighborhoods, they won't get any money. And if we only pick neighborhoods that are already attracting money, we'll get a lot of criticism. So they did 50-50. The problem is the money is all going to places like downtown Portland or Bend, Oregon, which don't really need the incentive. And the rural or immigrant communities I visited in Oregon basically got all dressed up and no one invited them to the dance.
You know, we didn't have time to cover a part of the book that I just thought was fascinating, which is sort of the front-end story of how Parker's think tank managed to get this thing through Congress. It's a fascinating part of the book, which I highly recommend. Before we go, you finish the book with a series of anecdotes, and after each you say, don't blame the players, blame the game. So I think what you're saying is that these incentives, capitalism is going to react to incentives in certain predictable ways. And some of these egregious examples that you point out are sort of the inevitable result of the flow of capital. Have I basically got that right?
Basically right. And the thing that I would add to that is that when you create some tax incentive, there is an industry of people, lawyers and wealth advisors and accountants who scour this thing and find ways to squeeze their clients' money into parts of the law that really were not intended. That's why it's so hard to use the tax code, because there's so many people who have such a vested interest in exploiting the tax code to cut their clients' taxes that they shred this stuff. And it makes you wonder whether we should even use the tax code for this purpose. Maybe we should just raise taxes and put the money in where we think it ought to go and be done with it.
A very interesting perspective. Thank you. We've been speaking with David Wessel, the author of a fascinating book about opportunity zones called Only the Rich Can Play.
Business and leadership consultants Susan Hans-Sykes and David A. Hyatt show how owners can keep themselves and their businesses on track. And yes, you can take a day off. Escape the 9 traps of growing your small business. Sykes and Hyatt wrote the book to help other owners recapture their passion, create the lifestyle and legacy they want from their business, and keep work and home life in balance. The book provides an honest look at the realities of running a business, the importance of working on the business rather than just in the business, and the best strategies for communicating in ways that causes customers, employees, vendors, bankers, and others to generate more revenue. Joining us this morning is one of the authors, Susan Hans-Sykes. Susan, thank you for being here with us on Mountain Money.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
So, you know, the title of your book says it all. Yes, you can take a day off, but I believe that if there are small business owners listening to this interview, they don't believe you. And and the reason for that is they fear that doing so would lead to a crisis. Why is this a common feeling?
So I do think that you're right. Maybe they don't actually believe us, but we'd like to get them to the point where they can. I think it's a common feeling for a number of things. A lot of small business owners are wearing multiple hats, and you know they're struggling with peaks and valleys and cash flow. They're trying to figure out just how to get everything into squeezed into a day. And then, you know, lastly, they're spending a lot of time working on what I'm going to call the tactics of the business, the day-to-day, and they haven't really invested the time to figure out strategy. In other words, they're working in the business rather than on the business.
You talk about something called the 9 entrepreneurial traps that drive business owners to the brink of burnout. Can you explain a little bit about what those are And, you know, how, and what do you mean by burnout and afterburn?
Sure, that's a great question. So when we think about burnout, as a business owner, you wake up, first let me just start with the way we start our business, right? We're all excited the day we begin to start our business, and we wake up and we can't wait to go to work. And then at some point, the stress of running the business and having a life outside of the business becomes a little daunting. I'm not going to say overwhelming, but it can become daunting. And we lose our sense of sort of fun with that. And if we're not careful, that can lead to burnout. And we forget what is it that caused us to start the business to begin with. And so when we talk about this concept of afterburn in the book, we really are relying on an afterburn analogy from a jet engine. So a jet engine isn't designed to run on afterburn forever, right? It's just that extra kick of energy that you need to re-engage or for a jet, it's really about the maneuver, right? To be able to execute a maneuver either at high altitudes to go supersonic or take off from an aircraft carrier. And for people, sometimes we need that extra boost of energy just to get back on track with our business and become re-engaged and excited again.
And I like that, as you've said, it's a boost. You're not looking at, you know, taking on another huge load to be able to get you there. As you've mentioned, energy is a key and important part that small business owners need to keep in a sense of. You know, it's also part of their sense of self-worth, their identity that determines how they perform in their roles. Can you talk about how this can kind of all relate to where they need to be in order to get to afterburn?
Sure. So when we think about afterburn and being able to really engage with our passion, it starts first with making sure that we've really taken the time to identify that. And we know, sort of the way I like to say it is, what gets me out of bed in the morning? And it's not the fact that I have to go to work or that I want to support my family or live in a certain neighborhood. There's some passion associated with that. So the first thing is we want to identify that. Secondly, and one of the most important concepts that I think we share in our book is this idea of understanding the difference between who you are and what you do. And we call that identity role. And so if I think about understanding who I am and my value, my intrinsic value as a person, and I can protect that and really accept that value is, we use an analogy of a scale of 1 to 10, it's always a 10, right? And then I can allow myself to have some in my roles. So that think of the role as what I do, whether that's being a mom or a business owner or whatever that role happens to be. If I can really accept that who I am, my intrinsic value as a human, is always unaffected by my performance in my role, it frees me up to risk failure and to be willing to challenge my comfort zones.
You talk about a series of traps, which I mentioned earlier. I'd like to explore a couple of those. One of the areas of traps is something you call a passion killer trap, which sounds like the prelude to a very bad date. Can you tell us what a passion killer trap is and its role in a small business?
Well, so in a way, I suppose you could say it's a prelude to a very bad date, and that would be a bad date in your business, right? So when we think about those things that really drain us of our energy, it's that idea of, you know, first up, it's not really connecting with your passion. What is the reason you get out of bed in the morning? And secondly, it's this idea of, I have to do everything myself. Nobody does it better than me. And if nobody can do it better than me, then I'm the only one that can do it. And that will certainly sap your energy pretty quick, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we talk about when we talk about this idea of passion killer is also the idea that, you know, hey, if I haven't, the vision setting is just for big companies, right? And what I want small business owners to begin to understand is your vision for your company is what, and your personal life are connected. So your personal mission and vision, it is the fuel that feeds the passion for your business's mission and vision. And so it's really important that you keep those things you document them, you write them down, you share them with people, and you keep them where you can go back to them to remind yourself of what you're doing. Because sometimes when we're in the quagmire of our daily life, it really can feel like, you know, why did I start my business? Why am I doing this? So that's really, I guess, you know, if you think about it like a bad date, that's a good analogy. Mm-hmm. It works for me. Mm-hmm.
As you've highlighted, you know, you keep going back to working on the business, not in the business, and delegating is one of those things that a business owner can do. But I took another statement that you wrote in the book, and it's, you know, you remind us that as long as we are the only ones who know how to complete a task or project, then we're the only ones who have to do it or can do it. And so, you know, can you further explain effective delegating and how do we begin that?
So that's a really great question. As we think about effective delegating, there's a lot of tools out there to do that. But the first thing that we want to recognize is that we have to train people to think the way that we think, right? So that they can make decisions in our absence. So you want to make sure you lay that good groundwork in that. And then as you think about delegating, so training and this idea of not delegating tasks often isn't because we don't know how to delegate. It's that we haven't effectively given people the guidelines to make decisions when we're not there, so that they can really not only take on the task, but the responsibility and the authority to go with it.
Do you think that this partly stems from ego, that the inability to delegate is directly related to the notion that nobody can do it as well as I do, and therefore I don't need to figure out how to give those guidelines?
I think there's a lot of that involved in it, and it might not be an ego as in, like, I think so highly of myself. It might just be that I haven't really put the time into figuring out what task are my highest and best use tasks, and what things should I really let go of? So sometimes it's a sense of you know, I just want to be able to control things, right? And in my own business, I personally am not really good at accounting and bookkeeping and those kinds of things. And when I finally let go of that and gave that to someone else that could do it, that doesn't mean I took my eye off the ball, but it does mean that allowed me to have some time to focus on my highest and best use task.
One thing that you just had said is, you know, you want your employees to think the way you think. But I think the book goes deeper into that, in that, you know, by setting the vision, it's that the employees know where the business should be going and they can make decisions based on that. Is that more the case?
Absolutely. And so I appreciate you bringing that up, because it's not that I want employees to think like I think, because I need all kinds of people around me and I need different ideas. But what I want to do is to make sure that the people that are on my team understand those things that are that I consider valuable and important, and that I've articulated that to them in a way that if I'm want to take a day off and go on vacation, they know how to set priorities and continue along with the mission and vision of the company.
And does that relate somewhat to the concept of a communication killer trap, the importance of having your employees understand the values and that are driving the company?
It does. You know, when we were thinking about putting these things in traps, it was really easy for us to put a lot of these different things in the different categories, whether it's communication killers or passion killers. They sort of overlap to some extent. Mm-hmm. But really, when we think about the communication killers, what we're talking about are those things that inhibit us from being able to clearly articulate our mission and vision, or in just simply to communicate with others, you know, in making sure that the message we're sending is the message that's being received. And as the sender of the message, it's my responsibility to make sure that that message is, let's say, encoded in a way or in a language that my receiver can understand.
I find it interesting that you do emphasize that business owners need to be aware of their communication styles. But I think a lot of business owners hold the thought that I'm too busy, and if they can't understand what I'm saying, then I've made the wrong hire. How should, you know, someone look at that and understand that a bit differently?
Well, I think if you consider that, I'll take it from a moment from a sales perspective, if I could. If I were thinking about selling something to you, it would be my responsibility as the salesperson to make sure that I created an environment in which we could communicate in order for me to make that, to allow you as a prospect, let's say, to make a good decision about whether or not we would work together, right? So if you think about that from a business owner perspective, it's really my business, and it's my job to make sure as the business owner that I've taken the efforts to communicate clearly, make sure that people around me really understand, right, where I want to go and what I expect of them. And if I haven't done that, then really that burden relies on me. Now, conversely, if I have done that, if I've done that work and I've really become good at communicating and I've skillfully communicated to an employee that, you know, that he or she should do or should not do something, then at that point it's easy for me to determine whether or not the problem is, you know, I made the wrong hire or the problem is my communication style.
And that kind of segues into the discussion that you make. We try to clarify the difference between marketing and sales. Talk a little bit about how those functions are different and why it's a mistake, even in a small business, to try to combine the two.
So when we think about marketing and sales, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, even in our brains, about what those two things are differently. And sometimes we want to combine them. I'll address that first. We want to combine them as small business owners because we're just trying to be efficient. And so it's completely understandable that when we have tasks that overlap, we want to try and combine those functions. However, the danger there is when we do combine them and we don't think clearly about what's the difference in a selling conversation and a marketing conversation, let's say, then we run the risk of extending our sales cycles and making things go way longer than they should, or even losing opportunities. So when we think about combining marketing and sales, one of the big reasons that it gets confused is a lot of the functions in the early part of the process are very similar. So for example, if you think about the prospect journey from someone who's a stranger just out there in the universe that may or may not have need for our products and service, all the way to someone that's has become a client, the activities that happen in that stranger, suspect, prospect world, those are very similar between marketing and sales because they both have responsibility to generate those sales. They both have the opportunity to generate leads, for example. And when we think about that, we have to divide that at some component. So what we look at in the book is we call it our meaningful conversations. So once we go from this sort of mass prospecting down to the individual's conversation, we call that a meaningful conversation. And that's where the sales process begins.
Your book, as you've given us a chance to understand, really does go into what are those traps for a small business owner. I want to just take our last minute and talk about your book, and it includes a 7-step template for revenue generation. So it takes it just a little bit farther than just working on your business in the sense of leadership. But a piece in the chapter highlights the two reasons why people make decisions. And I found it interesting, you know, how it said that humans are simple. Humans avoid pain or discomfort or seek pleasure or gain. And so you had even, you know, written the book helps you find real pain by introducing a tool called the Sandler Pain Funnel. So this is something I had never heard of before. Can you just talk about, you know, how a business owner can use this?
Sure. So when we think about the Sandler Pain Funnel, that's really, I want you to think about that as just a conversation guide. So if we think about like all things, people do move from pain, from move away from discomfort or move toward pleasure. And if we think about the Sandler pain funnel, that is really just a guide for a conversation to help us understand the difference between what we would call the surface level need, the reason somebody may have called us to start with, to really helping them move through a conversation to identify what's really the cause of the problem that, we're trying to deal with or solve at in our businesses. And so in doing that, we start really becoming a consultant with our clients and really begin to help them understand the challenges that they're facing and how we are uniquely positioned to solve them.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed our time with you. We've been speaking with Susan Hant-Sykes. She is the author of a new book, Yes, You Can Take a Day Off, Escape the 9 Traps of Growing Your Small Business. Susan, thank you for taking time with us this morning on Mountain Money.
So thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you.
Black Friday. A lot of attention from an economic perspective on Black Friday is supposed to focus on lines of retail shoppers, frenzy of holiday buying. But something else happened on Friday. The stock market dropped some 900 plus points, apparently on fears of a new coronavirus variant. The Nasdaq dropped 2.2%, the S&P dropped 2.3%, and the Dow dropped about 900, the most in a day since October 28th, 2020. So financial experts often tell us not to look at the everyday Dow as an indicator of something significant and long-term, but that was a lot. And so this morning we are really lucky to have with us Kathy Jones Price of KJP Wealth Management to talk to us about what happened on Friday, what's going to happen today, and how we expect new variants to affect the economy going forward. Good morning, Kathy, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, Allison. It's great to be with you, and happy Cyber Monday.
Oh, thank you.
And we might even get to the economics of Cyber Monday, but first, can you break down a little bit about what you think happened on Friday and a little bit about the sectors that were impacted differentially?
Absolutely. It was a very interesting day. As you know, it was a short trading day, which really made things worse from a volatility standpoint. So what happened is with this variant, it came out as being very uncertain, with South Africa being really impacted, travel shutting down immediately. So markets hate uncertainty. And so when that happened, the market just started to panic. Many in smaller investors or individual type investors maybe had been over leveraged. There's been record margin borrowing. Therefore, they started to make some moves. So as you might expect, the things that led the way down on Friday were things that were doing well because of the economy reopening. So things like cruise lines, airlines, travel, and then not too surprising, also the energy sector, thinking, you know, hey, less travel, lower gas demand, that kind of thing. On the flip side, some of the stay-at-home stocks that had been doing not all that well lately were positive, things like Zoom, Peloton, companies like that. And then also not surprisingly, the healthcare stocks like Moderna, Pfizer, and others, you know, they were up on Friday. So it was an interesting day. And again, because of the shortened trading day and frankly, not a lot of Wall Street taking the day off, it just made the volatility escalate.
Is that perhaps the reason why we saw a larger dip with the, you know, the emergence of this variant versus when we saw Delta or even Alpha come out?
Oh, I think so. Well, it remains to be seen. As I was listening to different forecasts this morning, it seems like the big thinkers have decided that we're basically going to wait and see what happens here. And for the most part, they're not changing their forecast. So as we speak, the Dow is up this morning 188.26, the S&P is up 55.95. So those are a bit off of where the market started off today. But the markets are starting to digest this information, so to speak, and you know, we'll see what happens.
One of the things that happened on Friday that you mentioned earlier was that oil prices dropped a little bit. You know, we're seeing continued focus on the energy sector, and in particular, sort of this increasing gap between the price of oil and the price we're seeing at the pump in gasoline. What do we think is going on there, and what do we think is going to happen to oil prices going forward?
Well, that's a really great question. It's tough to say because, you know, you have OPEC that's not backing off on production at all. In fact, they're marching forward with their plans. And you had President Biden, you know, release the 50, you know, the into the gas reserves. So it kind of remains to be seen. It makes one wonder with, you know, and I have no empirical evidence to back this up, but it makes one wonder. It's like, well, gee, you know, how come we're paying so much, like you say, when oil prices, you know, have taken a bit of a hit? Oil this morning is back up to over $70 a barrel at 70.66. So energy stocks were really beat up for a very, very long time, a good decade. And so is it just simply some profit taking while they know demand is strong? It makes you wonder that.
So talk a little bit about what we've observed from holiday sales over the weekend. Obviously, Cyber Monday numbers aren't going to come until today, but what do you see in terms of the message for the economy from the level of holiday sales, which I understand were pretty substantial?
Right, absolutely. Here's the interesting thing that you may think is a bit of a disconnect. Consumer sentiment came in at 67.4 for November, which is 6% below the low in April of 2020. So It, you know, it's like, what's going on? You know, consumers feel worse than they did at the worst of the lockdown.
It doesn't make
yet,
sense.
You know, sometimes when we feel bad, we spend. So, yeah, here we go. Retail sales and consumer personal consumption were up. And here's another interesting number. I just got this morning from one of the major banks. And they said their credit and debit card spending shows that consumer spending in November month to date, not including Cyber Monday today, is up almost 14% from last year. And discretionary spending, so excluding food, is up over 20% year over year versus almost 15% in October. So as the saying goes, when we feel bad, we go shopping. So we will see what happens there. But so that is good for the economy. Hopefully some of the supply chain issues are going to start to remedy themselves. But there are some definite structural changes still happening. Some of your major retailers that are in the high-end retail, boy, they have really continued to struggle. And their stocks have been way, way down, as much as 50%. So it's definitely a mixed bag. But in general, the consumer is strong and is stronger than it's ever been.
I want to go back to just those numbers you had mentioned with regards to spending to date per month this month, and that it, you know, it had increased. Are they looking at dollar amounts? Are they looking at number of transactions? Could inflation, you know, numbers play into any of that?
Yeah, sure. These are very preliminary numbers, so I don't have the breakdown between actual transactions and the numbers themselves. But so far, the notion behind it, you have to remember, is that consumers are taking inflation basically in stride, and that demand continues to be strong. If anything, what we see is that if inventories are lower, that means that could be a reason for people not to spend, not necessarily the prices. We have not seen that yet, that prices have been a big deterrent to the consumer spending.
You know, before we go, one of the most interesting things about where we are right now is that GDP is up, job growth is up, unemployment is down, and yet consumers think we're having a bad economy. I don't know quite how to figure that out. But Kathy, with this week's jobs report, what are we expecting, and do you think that that's going to have an impact on the market?
Absolutely. There's a lot of consumer good economic data coming out this week with, you know, ending on Friday with the November jobs report. From what I have been reading, it looks like the number is going to be strong again. And so that's good news for all of us, for sure.
We've been talking to Kathy Jones Price of KJP Wealth Management. Thanks for joining us, Kathy.
You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. Do you love Mountain Money? Let us know. Leave us a review.